My name is Norm Ferrier, and as Kyle suggested, I'm going to be talking a little bit this morning about the whole subject of emergency management in healthcare. It's not all clinical, and it's certainly not all what the clinical people would have you believe it is. In terms of my background, I do a great deal of work for the Ontario Hospital Association and for the member hospitals in Ontario, and I've also done some work for the healthcare system in Prince Edward Island as well. In addition to that, the courses that I've run at the Ontario Hospital Association have had students in them from literally every Canadian province and territory at this point. While I don't recognize any of the names on the list, I certainly welcome you all. I would like to get to know a little bit about you if I could, so there are a couple of questionnaires here that I would like to start out by asking you to answer, if that would be okay, just so I know who I'm talking to. So if you could take the time to fill these in, please. Okay, very good. That seems to be pretty close to everybody who's on the board, so I'll just move on to the next question if I can. And ask you which category best fits your job description. Well, this is absolutely great to see so many people from from facilities engineering involved in this particular presentation. You are probably the unsung heroes, if you will, of the entire healthcare system across Canada. The glory seems to all go to the clinical people, and the clinical people themselves really think that the building runs by magic if you stop and think about it. You can stop laughing whenever you want on that one because it falls into the sad but true category. One of the things that I found out over the years is that by asking simple questions when I'm dealing with my students who are primarily clinical people, and I will fess up on that, when I ask them how long their generator in their hospital that provides the emergency power will run without refueling, 95% of them have no idea whatsoever. They think that all of this simply operates by magic. And, of course, you know that you're the primary reason why it seems to be magic from their perspective. So let's push forward. I mean, there's a great deal of temptation in all hospitals to view emergencies as being largely about surge capacity. And in some codes, the entire emergency is in fact about facility services. It has very little to do with generating surge and demand for services whatsoever. To give you an example, a fire is a facility emergency. And that should be absolutely clear. Yes, all of you have code orange emergencies with large-scale influxes of patients from time to time, but the fire is actually the most likely of emergencies to occur in any hospital or any type of healthcare facility. And evacuation is probably the biggest single challenge that most hospitals will ever have to face. It has very little to do with creating a surge in demand for services, and in fact may simply be about getting the most vulnerable people in the community out of the building safely, and that's much more likely to happen than the code orange or similar types of scenarios. You folks provide what I like to describe as a seamless background, and that's part of the magic to this thing when you stop and think about it. This is why the clinicians don't really need to think about it. You're working in the background. Everybody sort of conveniently forgets that you are there. And none of the things that they need to work to do their job would be working unless you were there. They just don't know how anything works. They don't know how to deal with the most basic of facilities-related emergencies at 2 o'clock in the morning in the absence of somebody from facilities engineering. They don't know how to turn off medical gases in the fire. They don't know how to... They basically don't even understand how their fire suppression system works. They have no idea. We're going to cover three things today, three main areas of interest. The first is the role of facility services in hospital emergencies. The second is command and control models in hospitals during emergencies and the role of facility services within them. And finally, we're going to talk about which emergency codes are primarily the responsibility of facility services, and we're going to look at what the future might look like. If you have any questions at any time, please feel free to just put them down at the bottom left-hand portion of the screen, and as I get the opportunity, I will attempt to answer them for you. There's no such thing as a bad question. The only real bad question is the one that you don't bother to answer, and I'd rather have it now during the presentation than necessarily wait till the end of the presentation, because by then you might forget it. So just bear with me if I don't get to you right away, but I will get to you. So what's your role in emergencies? Sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? You're going to keep everything running. All of the stuff that the people in white know nothing about, your power systems, telecommunications, alarms and safety systems, water and sewers, medical gases, HVAC, and your physical structure. And hospitals are confronted with emergencies dealing with absolutely every one of these various issues. And in fact, sometimes multiple issues within a single day. There is a hospital in Toronto, Mount Sinai Hospital, which has in its folklore a day that it describes as Rainbow Day. And the reason they call it Rainbow Day is that over the course of one 24-hour period, every single emergency color code had to be implemented at some point, and that was, with the exception of code pink, that was the only one that wasn't addressed. But they had virtually every other problem that you could think of in a single day. And if you think the clinical people were busy, oh my goodness. They had no water at one point. They had no power at one point. They had a hazardous material spill. They had a partial evacuation to take care of. It was just a whole range of different things that occurred. The fire alarms went off. Fortunately, there was no fire, but there was certainly an alarm. So as you can see, your role in emergencies is not minor, and you're not spirit carriers. You, in fact, play an absolutely central role. And most of the people who I deal with in terms of training people to manage incidents inside emergencies really have very little idea what you do. They know how to do your core business, but you're the ones who know how to make everything happen, pure and simple. In some roles, in some emergencies, your role is supporting but essential, and we'll talk about that. Mass casualties, for example, evacuation, pandemic or outbreak, search scenarios. In some cases, facilities, people get involved in responses to aggressive behavior. Oftentimes, that will depend on the size of the hospital. But let's just start out with mass casualties. First of all, we're dealing with things like patient flow, and we're dealing with traffic management on the property. We may be dealing with what I call, everybody talks about surge capacity, but I also talk about something called surge capability, the ability to use different spaces or to use spaces that are available all day, every day, in different manners in order to expand your ability to treat various kinds of patients. And if you want to see an example of that, we're talking about things like establishing temporary triage areas or temporary treatment areas within places like lobbies and corridors and all of that sort of thing. But we could also be talking something much more complex than that. We could be talking about not having the ability or the capacity to deal with a large number of intensive care type patients and having to convert other portions of the hospital, most notably the recovery room, into improvised intensive care space, at least over the short term, until the emergency can be dealt with and the resources become available to redistribute, these patients to other facilities that can deal with them. Evacuation. You're absolutely central in this. You are the only people who understand the physical fabric of the building. That building houses what is arguably the largest concentration of vulnerable people in your entire community. And I would be willing to bet that 80% of the clinical people who work in your facility have never seen the inside of a staircase. This is becoming increasingly complicated because some hospitals are actually beginning to lock them to create unidirectional flows so the staff avoid them even more intensely. So the bottom line is the first time most of your clinical staff will ever set foot in one of your staircases is when an evacuation is actually in process and they have no idea how anything works in there. The only people who understand the emergency lighting, who understand the operation of the door systems and all of the rest of that is facilities management. Another issue that we need to consider is the whole pandemic and outbreak scenario. We learned an awful lot about that, particularly in 2003 during the SARS outbreak. Now, I was working in the healthcare system in Toronto at that time, and I can tell you there were things, fundamental changes in the way hospitals are designed and the way services are provided to various portions of the hospitals that had never really seriously been considered before that particular outbreak. And all of a sudden, we were talking about things like negative pressure rooms and all of that sort of thing that simply didn't exist outside of operating theaters and burn units prior to that. I mean, my goodness, at this point, the city of Toronto actually has a couple of negative pressure ambulances that are kept specifically for this kind of work. None of that existed before that. And who manages all of those negative pressure air management systems? Certainly not the clinical people. As far as they're concerned, all of this stuff just assembles itself by magic, and is there when they need it, and they use it without giving it a moment's thought. And that's really a compliment to you guys. It truly is, because you do what you do so well that they don't get the opportunity to think about it. Because they wouldn't think about it unless something went wrong, and it very rarely does. Search scenarios, missing patients, bomb threats. These are serious, serious issues. Bomb threats, perhaps not to quite the same extent. Yes, there have been some legitimate bomb issues in Canadian hospitals over time, but they are, in fact, relatively rare. And outside of a couple of large urban centers or places that are very close to the border, it doesn't seem likely that the terrorists are coming to the hospital anytime soon in most cases, but you might get a disgruntled family member calling in a threat. You may get a disgruntled ex-employee calling in a threat. All of these things become possible. As we also said, large numbers of missing patients. Code yellow is the most common code that is called in in Ontario healthcare, certainly. And it's not because we aren't keeping track of people. We have a million and one things to do. And unfortunately, some of these people are vulnerable by virtue of the fact that they are confused. They have Alzheimer's or they have some other form of dementia, and somebody's back is turned for just a moment and they wander off, and now the entire place has got to be searched. And I'll tell you, when it comes to searching these things, one of the things that we push with clinical people is the use of checklists, because they really don't know the facility well enough to conduct any kind of a search in any other fashion. So this is something that's part and parcel of the toolkit that is available through the Ontario Hospital Association, is this type of checklist. The reality is, this is very common. Missing patients are very common and very, very serious, too. There have, in fact, been any number at this point, probably upwards of 20 over the last 15 years, of deaths that have occurred from either hospitals or health facilities when someone who is elderly or confused or suffering some form of dementia managed to get out of the building and into the environment. And the environment in February in Canada is a very unforgiving place. And that happens, sadly, far too often. Another search scenario that you might have to consider is missing and abducted infants. We have noticed in Ontario a trend among hospitals where people are actually encountering people that they're describing as shoppers. And there's actually a fairly straightforward description of these people. They tend to be female. They tend to have suffered some sort of mental health issue, and they will wander from hospital to hospital, looking at the babies, trying to figure out how the security systems work. For all I know, they may very well be trying to decide which baby looks the best. And eventually, they will decide which baby they're going to relieve from the custody of a hospital. Now, this tends to happen more frequently along large transportation corridors, such as Highway 401 in Ontario. And once they get out of the building, and once they get out of the parking lot, best of luck finding them. There have been 57 infant abductions in North American hospitals in the last 20 years, and of those, 4 children were never recovered. And any number of these were, in fact, in Ontario. And I have no reason to believe that other provinces would not encounter the same kinds of scenarios. So that means that in all of these cases, the facility has to be locked down, it has to be thoroughly searched, and these people, we have to ensure that these people aren't in a utility room or a closet or a washroom somewhere, that they are legitimately gone, because sooner or later we're going to have to bring in the outside authorities on this, and we're going to have to be able to demonstrate not only that we look for this person, but that we look for them quickly and appropriately. And I'll tell you, in lockdown scenarios, most clinical people can't even tell you how many doors there are in and out of the building. They just don't know. It's not something that is an ongoing interest to them. Other scenarios, in some cases, particularly in smaller facilities, those who are involved in facilities management, particularly if there is no in-house security, may very well be asked to step in and assist the clinical staff in dealing with someone who's manifesting aggressive behavior. Now, this could be, in fact, a psychiatric patient. It could be, on a more clinical level, somebody with head injury syndrome or that sort of thing. It could be somebody who's confused and a diabetic and becoming aggressive. All of these things are possible. But it can also be angry parents, angry next of kin, It can be angry ex-employees. And I'll tell you, one of the most common ones and something you really need to be aware of is the whole issue of spouses of staff members who are estranged for whatever reason, and they may even be under a restraining order, and that doesn't seem to stop them from coming to the hospital and manifesting aggressive behavior. That is also a very, very common scenario. So these are some of the kinds of things that you end up hopefully only playing a supporting role in, but that role is absolutely essential. And how does that role work for you? Well, you could end up looking at all of the incident-specific resources that need to be assembled, because the hospital doesn't sit fully assembled and ready to function in a disaster on a day-to-day basis. Most of the information, most of the equipment that is required to deal with the special needs during a disaster exists somewhere in a kit. And all of the facilities that are used are multi-purpose facilities that are used for other things on a day-to-day basis. So it may very well be, for example, that your hospital's executive boardroom converts into a command center in which to run the facility during a crisis. And that's where the team that's going to manage the crisis will meet on a regular basis. Well, as you can appreciate, what the boardroom looks like in normal circumstances, it'd be very, very different from what a hospital command center would look like. You're going to need additional phone lines. You're going to need Wi-Fi service and supportive computers. You're going to need additional office supplies, additional office equipment, support staff. You're going to need somebody to make sure that the place is cleaned and maintained and operated in the background over an extended period in many cases. I mean, we had hospital command centers during SARS, for example, in 2003 that ran for 80 days. Also, things like family information centers. Where do you take the loved ones of the victims so that they're not driving the eMERGE staff absolutely crazy, but they can get the information and the resources that they need, and somebody can find them if the clinical people need to? So we set up a designated location for that with all of the support services. But again, it's got to be assembled. The media are always a problem, and there's this great temptation to simply lock the doors and refuse to provide the media with access to the premises. And I'll tell you from experience, that is the absolute worst thing that can happen. Because once you deny them access to their story, they're people doing a job like anybody else. And they will get the information that they need one way or another. And that's usually when the games begin. So to give you an illustration of this, most of you will remember the situation that occurred in London, England, where a number of London Underground stations were bombed on the same day, virtually almost simultaneously in some cases. Well, the Royal London Infirmary is the largest hospital in central London, and it was the first impact hospital. And as soon as this happened, the chief executive officer of the hospital decided, well, I know what to do with this. Ban the media from the premises as of right now. And he put security at every door and ensured that nobody could come in. Well, one member of the media took off his press pass, stuck it in his pocket, and walked in posing as a patient. Went to registration, got himself registered and everything else. The chief executive officer went back up to his office so that he could see what was happening, turned on the television in his office, and was absolutely stunned to see live video coverage coming from his own emergency room. Basically, what had happened is this reporter, who had a relatively minor complaint, was sat in the waiting area, and he simply waited until no one was looking, pulled out his smartphone, set up a link to his television station's newsroom, and then started running live video from his smartphone to the newsroom, which then took it live to air. And it took them a half an hour to figure out who this guy was. It's much better if you can provide the media with a workspace and then provide them with information that you're controlling rather than just simply locking them out and hoping for the best. But such a space, again, needs to be assembled. Same thing with staff staging areas, patient triage areas, and temporary treatment areas. You know, your staff may be pressed into service to assist with all sorts of things, assembling these areas. You know, a command center is probably going to require 24 telephones, and they're going to have to be telephones of a particular kind, and they won't be in the room until the room is actually needed as a command center. So these are the kinds of things that you need to consider. Other cases, it's your special expertise more often than not that's going to put you in a leadership role. Facilities management people have more experience with hazardous materials than anybody else in a hospital, with the possible exception of the lab. So they often play a leadership role in such things as internal hazardous material spills. And this includes things like membership on any kind of Code Brown response team or any of that sort of thing. The other reason they're critical in this particular scenario is that they are the only ones who understand how the HVAC system operates and how to limit the distribution of any vapors from the area where they're spilled to other areas in the hospital. Other issues you might have to deal with, utility failures of all manner. Power failures are the most obvious. If you're having a really bad day, though, and this has happened in a Canadian hospital, you can have a power failure in which the emergency power also fails. So now you have a 300-bed facility with no electricity at all. But also things like failures of water supplies, failures of sewer supplies. In Ontario, the hospital at Walkerton, because of contamination of the town water supply, ended up functioning without running water for in excess of 1 week. Now, you surely don't think that the clinical people had too much to do with that. Infection control, yes, but this was almost exclusively a utility emergency. Again, Mount Sinai in Toronto, they were doing construction outside and managed to two different sites, because the building was supplied by sewerage from two different locations, they managed to cut through both of the pipes at the same time. So now you've got an 18-story building with no sewers. Structural failures happen from time to time. External air exclusion, again, is another one. I know of one hospital in Ontario where, and this is a brand new hospital, which to me is particularly frightening. They have a rail line literally outside the door of the hospital, which moves 6 or 7 train loads a day of hazardous materials right past the front doors to the hospital. I figure it's only a matter of time before somebody is going to have to button down the entire facility. And that will happen at some point. And again, fire. In terms of internal resources, yes, you have to deal with your local fire department, you have to deal with your local fire inspectors, and the fire codes and whatnot exist for a reason, but there's nobody in your facility who has your knowledge or your expertise at dealing with any of these situations. In terms of command and control models, most of you have probably heard of incident command or incident management system. Basically, what has happened is in Ontario, we have developed a model called the Healthcare Emergency Command and Control System, or HECS. Now, the problem that we found in dealing with the local provincial emergency management people is that they were very, very much interested in IMS, in the incident management system, but they wanted a strictly generic model with everybody interchangeable and no special consideration given to the needs of any specific agency. And as you know, hospitals are not like the rest of the community. The highest concentrations of vulnerable people in the whole community are typically in the hospital. things operate a little differently in a great many hospitals, and hospitals are almost by definition more vulnerable. Similarly, hospitals require a level of expertise in terms of dealing with the clinical side of things and in terms of dealing with hospital operations that those in the community sector typically don't possess. And when it comes to an external emergency in the community, they simply don't have the ability to, they can't spare people from inside the hospital to go out and fill a role outside the hospital. And that's the kind of model that was being proposed in Ontario. So what we came up with instead, and this has also happened in the United States with a model called HICS, a model which is the incident management system without any question, but very specific to healthcare roles. This is a hospital and healthcare-centric version of either incident management or the incident command system. And it meets the needs of the healthcare system far better than the mainstream models. And that includes things such as checklists for staff, so that if you've got a nurse or a site engineer at 2 o'clock in the morning who hasn't encountered this particular kind of emergency before, can go over to their binder, pull out a checklist, and start working from that checklist until such time as somebody with designated responsibility arrives. It makes things a lot simpler, and it makes things a lot safer. So what does this model look like? Well, there's nothing new under the sun. If you've seen an IMS model, you've seen a HECS model. They are essentially the same thing, and they have to be that way because part and parcel of the strength of dealing with IMS or incident command is the ability to interact with other agencies. And as you look at this model, you will note that there are two colors, there are two boxes that are of primary importance here and are slightly darker color. The incident manager, who is in charge of the system, and whoever is doing operations, which is the second most important box. And what are the differences between the two? Well, the incident manager is, in fact, in charge of the incident. The operations person deals with the core business of the organization, whatever that core business happens to be. So if you're a hospital, this is about the throughput of care and care of patients, or perhaps about the evacuation of patients. If you are the fire department, the operations box is about fire suppression and rescue and hazardous materials. All of these other boxes exist in some fashion specifically to deal with needs that are likely to occur during any kind of an emergency and to support either this box or this box. So, public information, your media moguls. These are the people who are going to deal with the incident with the media on behalf of the incident manager. They will be the ones who will conduct any media conferences, write any media releases, do any of that sort of thing. Because let's face it, let's be honest here, if the incident manager is standing in front of a camera with a microphone jammed under their nose, they're looking at the camera and they're looking at the microphone, they're not looking at the incident. We need to have them free in order to be able to do that. So, what we do is the incident manager, when he or she deems it appropriate, delegates responsibility downwards and says to the public information person, right, you've got the background for this, so let's turn all of this over to you. Don't release anything without approval, but I want you to deal with all of the media on my behalf, and and should anything come up, please come back to me. Similarly, safety. Hospitals are not the safest places on earth on a day-to-day basis, but if you're in crisis mode and everybody's operating at triple speed and taking shortcuts, what do you think happens to safety? Well, that doesn't exclude the incident manager from responsibility for the safety of everybody on the site, but do they have the time to actually go out and tour the place constantly and make sure that there are no safety violations? Absolutely not. So what they do is they designate that responsibility to somebody with an appropriate background. Could be a full-time safety officer. It could be a It could be a certified member of your Joint Occupational Health and Safety Committee. In some cases, there may be special knowledge that's required. So if you're dealing with an outbreak scenario or something like that, your safety person may end up being an infection control professional. Or if you're dealing with a radiation spill, for example, within the hospital, it may be somebody from diagnostic imaging who has the best understanding of that sort of thing. Liaison. People in healthcare, and I'm sure you've all experienced this, will meet about just about anything, and they will go right on meeting until such time as consensus is reached, and then they will move forward. Healthcare people are the best consensus managers in the world. Problem is, this is crisis management. As you know, if you try to manage a crisis by consensus, you're never going to get anywhere. You'll never get ahead of the issues. So what they do is they appoint someone as an ambassador of sorts. And that person's job is to go to all of the meetings on behalf of the incident manager, because they sure don't have the time to meet with everybody, gather the appropriate information, disseminate information to other agencies as required, and bring their information back to the incident manager. Operations is about core business. This is what we do on a day-to-day basis. Planning is about figuring out what's needed. Logistics is about sourcing and delivering what's needed. Finance is about paying for what's needed, pure and simple. So this one, and this one are essentially in support of the incident manager. And below that, this is where we're going to conduct our core business. This is where we're going to figure out what's needed to support that core business. These people are going to find it and deliver it. These people are going to use it, and these people are going to pay for it. Simple, straightforward, logical. In this model, senior facility staff will most often fill the role of logistics lead. In this role, they're doing essentially what they do on a day-to-day basis. They're making sure that the building runs. There may be some overlap in there because other pieces that come into the logistics puzzle are things such as supply chain and human resources, but somebody has to be in charge, and you may in fact find that there is a group of people who are tentatively pre-assigned to that facilities role logistics role that will include a mix of facilities, HR, and supply chain types. The other thing that facilities does is to act as an expertise resource to the incident manager. Incident managers are almost always senior clinical people, and as I've said from the very start of this presentation, really don't have a great deal of knowledge about how the building actually functions, what's possible and what's not. You can't find clinical people who know how HVAC works, how emergency power works, water and sewers, how to turn off medical gases, or any of those kinds of things. But they need to have somebody who does. And guess what, folks? 9 times out of 10, that's going to be you. In some cases, you're the logical people to lead. So things like fires, structural failures, major utility failures, and hazardous material spills are something that are actually beyond the knowledge base of the clinical personnel. And as a result, more often will fall into your bailiwick. Facility-specific emergency codes, red, gray, and brown, with major roles to play in yellow, white, and black, and amber. Facilities will probably have multiple duties in a fire. Some are going to be leaders. You may end up being liaison because the fire department is going to want to talk to somebody who understands the way the building works, not somebody who's interested in maintaining nice relations and all of that. And some of you, if there's nobody else to pick up the slack, will end up being lifters and carriers. You may very well end up carrying patients downstairs and all of that sort of thing. More often than not, the clinical people, the vast majority of clinical people, are going to be completely preoccupied with patient movement, but you know the way your hospitals are staffed, and you know that at 2 o'clock, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, there aren't enough clinical people to, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for that matter, there aren't enough clinical people to move all of the patients to a safe location in the event of a fire. So this is one of those cases where it's an all hands kind of situation, and you will very likely find yourself playing a role in this. Fire's about the building. I mean, that should be basic to anybody, and your staff understand the building better than anybody else. Firefighting is more about engineering than anything else. And in fact, if you go to Europe, one of the things that you'll find is that fire departments, European fire departments, will hire anybody off the back, you know, to be on the back step of the truck and actually run a hose and that sort of thing. But they tend to recruit their officers directly from engineering schools. So the captain on any given truck will not get to be a captain without being a structural engineer or the equivalent. That's just the way they have decided to do things. And they've decided that it is easier to teach a structural engineer how to fight a fire than it is to teach a firefighter how to be a structural engineer. And let's face it, this is a fire is an engineering emergency as much as it is anything else. Other staff may be tasked with ensuring function of critical communication systems and overhead paging if you still have it in your facility, or evacuation routes. Because let's face it, in this kind of scenario, the last thing we want to have to do as communications fail is to have people, have runners literally carrying messages from one part of the building to another, because that's how people get lost and that's how people get hurt. And in many cases, initial firefighting, and this is certainly true in most of the rural hospitals in Ontario, is often performed by designated facility staff until such time as the fire department arrives. And they aren't coming nearly as quickly as they would like you to believe they are, particularly in rural areas. I live in a little town in Ontario called Newcastle, and we have a volunteer fire department. And their first response to a structure fire in our community averages 12 minutes. That's the first truck pulling up at the door. And that being the case, you want to know you do know. I don't need to tell you what can happen with a fire within a 12-minute span without somebody dealing with it. So really, in rural communities with volunteer fire departments, you don't have any choice. Somebody's going to have to do it, and facilities people are the logical people until such time as the fire department gets there. Code gray, the catch-all. This one has been used in so many ways by so many people. Internal utility failures, external air exclusion. Some hospitals use it for weather emergencies. And basically, it's become a catch-all for anything else that didn't have its own code. As far as we're concerned, we're starting to look at this a lot more seriously. And it should still be used for internal utility failures. Anything to do with power, telecommunications, HVAC, water, medical gases, anything like that should still end up being code gray. And as you can see from the list of things we just outlined there, you're the logical people to deal with this. You're the people who are going to have to deal with it anyway. External air exclusion itself should be moved to the code brown procedure. And the procedure itself, the code brown procedure itself, needs to be modified to specify either internal or external. And what this does is this ends up leaving code gray solely for utility and structural failures, and they're clearly your responsibility. Did I just skip one? I did. Pardon me for that. Hazardous materials. In many, many facilities, the facility staff will often play a major role in response to hazardous materials. And this is true whether it's internal or external. Simple truth of the matter is, in external scenarios, your facility staff are the only ones in the organization who understand how the ventilation system functions and how to exclude external air, permitting other staff and patients to shelter in place. Lots of hospitals these days have their own Code Brown response teams, and many of the staff on most Code Brown response teams are from facilities management. They often have the best understanding of the materials that are in the building. They often understand the physical fabric of the building, how to limit access, how to limit airflow. And facility staff are often, unlike clinical staff, accustomed to working with potentially hazardous materials and the safety procedures and PPE that go along with these jobs. You will often find, for example, in hospitals that the only people in the entire building who have any knowledge whatsoever of dealing with self-contained breathing apparatus are your facilities people. So they are the logical people to pitch in with this kind of thing. And I don't know what's happening elsewhere in the province, but I can tell you that in Ontario, fire departments are increasingly reluctant. They don't have the resources themselves, and they don't have the training in a great many cases to come in and deal with a hazardous material spill and clean it up for you. They will, if they absolutely have to, come and assist you in controlling and limiting access and all of that sort of thing, and expect you to either have your own staff or bring in a contractor to manage the actual cleanup. So what does the future look like for emergency management in Canada? Well, the Ontario Hospital Association has introduced a credentialing process for emergency managers specifically working in healthcare settings. The Certificate in Healthcare Emergency Management is what it's called, and it's intended to become a professional credential within healthcare settings. Now, how is this going to work? Well, three short courses, actually very similar to what a lot of provincial EMOs, particularly the ones that still have the resources to pay for such things, would do if they could. The first is emergency planning and response. That's essentially a command and control course. That's where you will learn the HEX model. That's where you will learn the fundamentals of writing an emergency plan. The second course is called Emergency Exercise Design and Education, and that's all about how you test your plan and train your staff. The final piece is the Hospital Command Center Design and Operations course, and that's about figuring out what space you can use in a hospital for a command center, what you need in terms of resources, and how to get it all there and working when you need it. You complete those three courses, and you, at that point, can choose to challenge an online exam with a 70% pass rate. Once you have succeeded in doing that, it permits the use of the postnominal CHEM after your name. It has a 3-year recertification cycle through the Ontario Hospital Association by either rewriting the exam or by continuing education points. And we are in the process, even as we speak, of either identifying education that is available from other sources that is appropriate for continuing education points. So things like courses on risk management or on project management, courses on Lean or Six Sigma or that sort of thing, but also some very specific emergency management related hospital courses. So things like the OHA is introducing a course next spring called Evacuation of Hospitals. And essentially what it will come down to is if you pass three of these courses over the 3-year period, you don't have to rewrite the exam. You've got a 3-year bye. What else is new? Well, we're looking at new codes. As you know, Ontario initially standardized the codes, and then through the Canadian Healthcare Association standardized them across the country. And we have revisited them from time to time, and I know that various provinces are at various levels of keeping up with this. The last time this was revisited was 2008, if memory serves, and we are in the process of revisiting it yet again in order to reintroduce three new codes. The first of these will be Code Bronze, which will be pandemic and outbreak type scenarios. The second, which is becoming very common in the United States and actually in some places in Western Canada as well, is Code Silver, which will be an active shooter or armed individual on the premises. Isn't healthcare getting interesting, guys? And the final piece of this puzzle will be Code Gold, and that will represent the movement of all natural hazards, all severe weather, all earthquakes, all landslides, subsidence, anything like that, from Code Gray over to having a code in its own right. So Code Bronze, the pandemic and outbreak, we're talking about things like facility lockdown, air management issues, negative pressure, major building maintenance issues, how do you deal with waste during a lockdown scenario, staffing and supply chain issues. Does any of this sound like it belongs to facilities management? I think it does. I think this is going to be a major new place for facilities management to look in terms of emergency management over the next decade. Code Silver, an active shooter, major lockdown and restriction of movement issues, major safety issues. This requires huge rethinking of both communications and access controls, and also some rethinking of building design. We need to be finding ways to make hospitals easier to lock down and easier to provide security to staff within the building. Code Gold, natural hazards, earthquakes, subsidence, flooding, severe weather, so hurricanes, tornadoes, severe winter storms, severe summer storms, lightning strikes. That lightning strikes one is a big one. I know of one hospital in Ontario that had one lightning strike that resulted in excess of $100,000 worth of damage to their physical plant. Among other things, they had to replace the chiller on their HVAC system. So, again, every one of these new codes has a major role for those who work in facilities management. So you're going to be looking at things like building structural issues, rethinking of support and safety systems, a lot to do with future hospital and facility design. Where do you place things within the structure? How do you deal with the fundamental principles of emergency management, which include things like multiple layers of redundancy and technological separation of your critical primary and backup critical systems? I can remember doing a survey back in 2000 of Canadian hospitals where I asked them how they would recall staff in an emergency. And 90% of them said that they would use the telephone. And when the next question asked them what they would do, how they would recall staff if the telephone system were not available, 90% of them said they would use pagers. Now, how we're going to use pagers if the phone system is not working is kind of an interesting point for discussion, but the reality is that what this does is it illustrates for all of you precisely how little the people in charge of running the place understand about what is actually going on and what your role is. So every one of these new roles or these new codes is going to have key roles for facility staff. You need to be looking to the future in terms of becoming a key player in terms of preparedness and mitigation efforts and a key player in response and recovery efforts. Other challenges that you're going to be looking at include things like P3 facility construction. Now, that is a huge trend here in Ontario. In fact, virtually all of the new hospitals that have been constructed over the last 5 or 6 years have, in fact, been public-private partnerships. And hospitals are, in fact, experiencing some challenges in dealing with some of those types of arrangements from an emergency management perspective, and sometimes even from simple day-to-day operations. And it takes a little bit of time for everybody to understand how everybody else works. And that's going to take a little while. We're not out of the woods there yet. Integration of emergency response activities with the community so that hospitals aren't functional islands sitting in the middle of a community that has its own problems and is making assumptions about what the hospital can and can't do. And also creating facilities which are far more resilient than we have seen up to this point. And I'm going to wrap it up there. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, hi, Sharp. I can tell you that you're welcome to, as far as I'm concerned, if Chess is prepared to share the presentation with you, you are more than welcome to have it. And yes, you're more than welcome to have it. And as far as information about the CHEM process goes, if you go to the Ontario Hospital Association website and go to the continuing education page, you will find virtually everything that you need right there, and that's www.oha.org. Now, Howie, in terms of two-way radios, I can tell you that increasingly you're starting to see two-way radios. They're still essentially two-way radios, but a great many of them are being replaced by smartphones. I know of one hospital, for example, where their entire senior management team are walking around with BlackBerry smartphones, and they are carrying complete copies of the emergency plan and all of their FANUC lists and everything else, and this is what they use to recall staff and to text to one another during a crisis and all of that sort of thing, and they love it. Frank, in terms of who has the authority to authorize a code, well, there are two schools of thought on that. Most people, most senior management, are very, very frightened of the potential of just letting go of the reins. But the simple fact of the matter is that they're not in the building 24/7. So what needs to happen is any employee who is aware of a problem, as far as I'm concerned, should have the ability to activate the first stage of a code of any description, and that way they can that can be confirmed by senior staff once senior staff arrives. Is everybody clear on that? Do we have any other questions? Okay, on that basis, I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'll just put my information up here, and if you need to get a hold of me for whatever reason, please feel free to contact me. The best way is probably email, although I am also available through Skype and through my usual phone numbers, and we'll just leave it there, and I thank you very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Norm, for taking your time to share your wisdom with us. Anyhow, to all you who dialed in, thank you all as well, and enjoy the rest of the day. Take care, everybody.